It's one of Australia's most baffling unsolved missing persons cases. In 2007, four people, including a five-year-old girl, vanished in Western Australia amid rumours of bizarre behaviour, cults and long-hidden secrets.
Yep, we're trying to track them down.
I'm Dominique Bayens and I've been investigating for the new season of Expanse, the Nan Up 4. Search Expanse on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
A balaclava, a water jug, and a milk bottle. These are the three items the prosecution says are key to identifying who killed Irma Palasik, and now the DNA recovered from them has started to be presented to the jury. I'm Stephen Stockwell. Welcome to episode 5 of The Case of the Two Intruders.
Irma Palasik's brutal murder rocked her family and has haunted them for 24 long years.
This wasn't the average robbery.
The brutality of the attack shocked the community.
They were virtually tortured that night.
Violently assaulted before the two men ransacked the premises and stole cash and jewellery.
My grandparents were beaten and my grandmother was left to die on the lounge room floor.
In 1999, DNA crime scene evidence was in its infancy, which is what makes the evidence we've heard over the last couple of days so important. It's a key part of the prosecution's case against Joseph Ficconi and Steve Fabrizi. And in court has been Canberra court reporter Elizabeth Byrne. G'day, Liz.
Hi, Stocky.
And as well as Elizabeth, we've got ACT investigative reporter James Viver back with us. Welcome back, James.
Hello.
Liz, before we dive into this episode, can you give us a wrap of the last couple of days in 60 seconds or so?
Well, this is definitely the weedy part of the trial. It's deep in the detail of the enormous amount of work that goes into an investigation. But the science is fascinating. Combine that with the fact most of this work was done 26 years ago, with materials gathered and DNA preserved in case one day it might lead to who visited the Palasiks that night. After days of gruelling questioning, the forensic officer who managed the crime scene, Clifton Frost, was finally freed. Now the court's hearing from the biologist who processed the samples, who's now the Northern Territory's chief forensic officer, a woman whose career has spanned hugely important developments in DNA technology. But it was some of that early work she did in 1999 that led directly to this trial.
Thank you, Liz. The DNA evidence we've heard over the last couple of days has been fascinating. And as you say, is so important in kind of getting us to the place we're at the moment. You know, so much foresight in 1999 to preserve this in the way that it was preserved and test this in the way that it was tested. I mean, I think the milk bottle and the water jug, these are two of the key pieces of evidence that we've talked about in this trial so far. I mean, what are we looking at here? What's happening?
Well, we learned obviously from Clifton Frost how they took it out of the fridge on day 5, took the swabs, and then those swabs were sent to Jo Lee, who was working in the lab as the biologist. And she's given us quite a good rundown, actually, of how she would have processed those swabs, how they were left to dry, because some of them were wet swabs, for a day or so, and then sealed up. But also that the bit she'd cut off, they cut off a little bit of it to process it. They don't do the whole thing. And she took us step by step through what she did in the wake of the forensic investigation of the house.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to actually unpacking the various steps of the DNA extraction process, because I really kind of learnt a lot about how this works from there. James, before we get to that though, can you remind us why these items are so important, the water jug and the milk bottle?
Well, like we've talked about in previous episodes, Stocky, what is alleged by the prosecution is that whoever owns that DNA, if you like, were the people that committed the offence.
Yeah. And we've heard the prosecution allege that one of the defendants was on the milk bottle and one of the defendants was on the water jug, right?
Yeah, that's right. So there were two separate DNA profiles, one from the milk container, as you say, and one from the lip of the water jug, the spout.
Yeah, oh, great. We'll get into kind of a bit more about how that's all come through. And there's other items as well that we'll talk about in this episode too. But Liz, what sort of detail is Jo Lee taking the jury into here? I mean, her name is Catherine Joanna Lee, but she likes to be called Jo Lee. So we'll lean into her preferred name for this episode. Where's she gone with this? Has she taken us into like how she's pulled this all apart and found these profiles?
Yes, she has. And in fact, I think I learned quite a bit from this after I've sat through so many trials, heard so much about DNA, but I learned more from her than I have before. Once she's got the sample and she's found, you know, the little bit of DNA, the first step they go through is to burst open the cells, and that's to free up the little bits of DNA. Mm. And then they have to store it. Now, they store it in a freezer at minus 80 degrees Celsius, and that is the optimum temperature to maintain the quality of the DNA that's been collected. There's a second step when they're sort of working out what's there and how to work out the final bit about who it might belong to. The second step is to determine how much DNA is in that sample. Mm. And then they go through a process they call amplification. So what they do, it's like photocopying DNA so that they've got more and more to compare it with. So there's only a little bit. And this is sort of part of the trace DNA technology that was beginning to be developed around that time. Mm. And they get this amplification going, get some copies. And then the fourth step, where they separate the pieces of DNA they have and match it to other DNA samples. And that's where they produce the graphs.
Got it. There were a lot of new words that I was learning throughout this, James. I mean, did the jury at least have a glossary of some sort to help them through this?
There's a lot of red squiggly lines in my notes from court yesterday and previous days, Stocky, because I'm sort of going, well, that's roughly that. And I sort of had to spell check and look them up later. That graph that Liz is talking about, shortened to an EPG, is an electropherogram.
Great.
Which is essentially the chart on which the DNA profiles are placed, mm-hmm, for analysis. So that's one thing that I learned, and certainly the jury was learning. There was the new type of DNA analysis, extraction and analysis, that was in that very early stage, as we've described. They were so early on in this methodology, but it was called capillary electrophoresis. Now, this is, and bear with us, listeners, but this is, you use a capillary, so a very thin tube, as opposed to a gel, for the extraction process that Liz has just described. So, you know, we're going to get a cert four in forensics by the end of all of this, perhaps. One that people might be a bit more familiar with, at least visually anyway, is an Eppendorf tube. So this is a tiny little plastic tube that anyone who's done one of those horrible COVID tests where you have to put a swab up your nose and twizzle it around and then sort of twizzle it in the little plastic tube with the liquid in, something like that little plastic tube. That obviously probably a bit more of a higher standard, a lab standard, but an Eppendorf tube is where they carry out they place these samples to carry out the DNA testing. So right. Yeah, lots of things beginning with E that I didn't know about, you know, 36 hours ago, but I do now.
Great. No, thank you, James. Appreciate the glossary, basically, of the various DNA terms. We are talking about 1999 here. This is when Irma Placics was killed during this home invasion. I mean, I think I spoke in one of our first episodes that, you know, CSI, the TV show where I learned about DNA evidence from, doesn't come out until the early 2000s. I mean, you know, is this one of the first crime scenes that they're really sort of starting to use DNA to examine, Liz?
Yes, that's right. In fact, Jo Lee said, she didn't say it was the first, but she said it was one of the first where they started to use these techniques. And the most important thing to take from this, I think, is that it wasn't just the analysis of it at the time. It's that they worked out how to store it and keep its integrity, because that's what has led to this trial. Because they stored those samples in the way that they did, they were later able to match it to other DNA as the technology developed.
Mm. And James, you know, did we hear much about how the technology has improved?
Yeah, this came up in the cross-examination, Stocky, and as we heard in the openings, Travis Jackson said it's not CSI, and then we heard on the other side from the prosecution about the strength of the DNA evidence and the testing and so on. So as we've signposted previously, or rather the jury has heard it from both sides, this is absolutely the fulcrum of the whole case. Mm. What came up in the cross-examination of Dr. Lee was the difference between the technology that, as Dr. Lee said, it was in the infancy at its time versus today. And so that was in 1999, as they were bringing this technology online, they were using something called Profile Plus kits. And these looked at typically 9 locations on the DNA molecule, plus a sex indicator, so male, female. Whereas today, it's the more advanced kit look at 24 markers, including the sex indicator. So obviously, technology moves forward. That was covered in the cross-examination, and that capillary electrophoresis, which now everyone knows what that is. at the time, that was only done with one capillary, whereas modern machines now use either 8 or 16, Dr. Lee told us, which gives more fidelity and speeds things up. So that was brought up in the cross-examination from both the defense barristers when they spoke with Dr. Lee.
Yeah. Got it. And as well as the bottle and the jug that we've been talking about here and some of the processes that Joe Lee's gone through to extract DNA from those items, another key piece of DNA evidence has come from a balaclava. Now, this was recovered from an earlier robbery of the Palasics. This was in 1998. The robbery where Irma died was in 1999, the following year. How was this balaclava tested, Liz? What did we hear about the processes they went through to extract DNA from this?
Well, there seemed to be several things they did, as well as a physical examination of it. Mm. They took tape lifts, and how they do that is they have sterile sticky tape, and they took some tape lifts off it. That collects hair and things like that and DNA. And this goes back to that excellent storage solution they'd come up with for the DNA, where they test like about, in 2014 or some many, many years later, they were able to test the DNA, that some of the DNA that they found on that balaclava, and to find that it matched the DNA in the fridge on the water jug. Mm-hmm. But that was how advanced we had gotten by that stage, that they were able to match it. Mm. There were other exercises a bit later, which we haven't got to in the trial, but that was a very important development in this case.
Yeah. James, what have you heard or what did you see about the way they were going about that kind of balaclava testing?
Yeah, as Liz said, those tape lifts Dr. Lee described to the jury, she recovered or were recovered 20 hairs from the balaclava of various different colours, from fair to light brown to dark, from both inside and outside, sort of summing up the hair-gathering moment in this case. Some sections were also cut out of the balaclava, and the jury was introduced to a diagram about where those sections were cut out, and this was to perform other testing to do with saliva. But in terms of the DNA, as Liz was describing, because the technology was still early on, notwithstanding that the samples were preserved, what Dr. Lee described in court was that they lacked the necessary follicular material, so the roots of the hair, right, required for the testing kits available at the time. And as technology progressed, those things became more available. Saliva testing was the other DNA profiling that they were able to extract, or the method that they used. Dr. Lee also described how they establish whether there is saliva on the material. They use a kind of a gel which essentially shows up when there's saliva. It tests for amylase, so that is a substance in our saliva that breaks down starch. So once they've done that, they then extract the DNA, and that's another profile that they can establish and test and so on. Interestingly, there was a brief moment again that might signpost to something coming up from the defense in the future to do with this theory or some studies that might exist, and this was put to Dr. Lee, about DNA transfer perhaps via a shared washing machine. Now, Dr. Lee hadn't heard of this, and the follow-up from Ms. Jerome was, are you aware of studies that show that this is possible? And she said, no, I'm not. I'd have to look at them. And what Dr. Lee said about this general idea, that it was basically pretty unlikely based on her knowledge, and as we've described, quite a long career, she said that it was very unlikely that saliva would be transferred in this imaginary theoretical washing machine, though it was more likely that hair could be transferred from one garment to another, but nevertheless, pretty unlikely.
Got it. Thank you, James. You know, we've got these three items, the milk bottle, the water jug, and the balaclava. I mean, we've spoken briefly about some of the DNA that's kind of popped off of this. I mean, from Jolie, did she give any kind of solid example or solid link to anyone at the time that she was going through this process?
No, she didn't. Not yet, anyway. Maybe that's coming. We don't know. Mm. With the trial, of course, things unfold as they go. Yeah. But she, like Mr. Frost, Clifton Frost, who was asked a lot about contamination at the scene and best practice and that those sorts of questions, she was getting those sorts of questions as well. And really batting them away, because by the time it got to the lab, there were quite strict procedures in place. And so she was able to describe those.
Yeah.
So, yeah, she hasn't given us an indication, though, yet about whose DNA she'd been dealing with.
Yeah, got it. And, I mean, we've heard about so many other people in the house as well. You know, when we're hearing from Clifton Frost, he was being asked a lot about other police that were in the house at that time. Obviously, Gregor and Emma Palacix lived in that house, so their DNA would be all over it as well. We heard about the dogs who were getting around as well. I mean, did we hear much about how those DNA profiles are ruled out or kind of, you know, removed from the pool of potential contributors at all?
Not a great deal, but there was some effort to do that. The thing that interested me, because remember, this was all in its infancy, and particularly one of the things that was being developed at this time was the trace DNA analysis. But I thought that it was interesting. They didn't even have a DNA database at the time. She told us that they eventually did develop one around that time, and it had about 200 people in it, and most of them were men.
Mm-hmm.
And then they made a separate database of all the people who worked in the team.
Right.
So that they could do cross-referencing. But that was sort of a general thing. Mm. They would have used it for this case, obviously, but that was only just being developed. They were only just starting to use that. So, yes, there were attempts to rule out other people who'd been at the scene, including there was some evidence about a handprint that had been found, but they knew that it was from one of the police officers when he arrived at the scene and had to jump the fence or something. So, you know, there was a purpose for that having been there. So they were ruling themselves out and the Palacics out, but even that was still being developed at this time.
Yeah. Fascinating to hear how they're kind of building these databases at the time as well. You know, this idea that, you know, they're going through the process and going, oh, hang on, we need to get the profiles from all of the police, all the people at the scene. So if that shows up anywhere, we can rule them out. So yeah, really paints a picture of how early on in this process we are here. And Liz, as you've talked about, you know, the kind of the foresight of the people involved to work on how to store these things, you know, really getting into the weeds of all of this detail, James, and like so many exhibits, so many things that are being presented to the jury, so many new terms. How are you and how do you think the jury's going kind of keeping across all of this?
Well, I'm taking notes as we go along and doing my best to keep up with the capillary electrophoresis and others. There are, which, you know, the jury has complete access to, obviously, there is a catalogue of exhibits and things that are entered into evidence and so on. Mm. But if you add to that a lot of page numbers, a lot of item numbers, a lot of stickers, a lot of, you know, tabs on things, there is just a lot of sort of word clutter, if you like.
Mm.
And as the prosecution and the defense go along, you know, they're taking witnesses often through documents and really just asking them to read them out. So, you know, I was left with the impression that the jury will need a lot of help with such a detailed scientific case like this in the summing up. And that will be really important once we get there, as it is with any case, but particularly with one like this, where there is, you know, corresponding timelines, two sets of charges, two defendants with two different defenses and enough page numbers to make your head spin.
Yeah, that's summing up, James. Those closings are such an important part of any trial. And I guess the reason we're going into so much detail here is that, you know, we don't know what the defense barristers and what the prosecution barristers are going to kind of point to in their closing to say, this is my point, and it's evidenced by this piece of evidence, this piece of evidence, this piece of evidence. So we get all of this information, and then, you know, it is effectively kind of cherry-picked by the barristers in their closings to really make their case to the jury before they make their deliberations. So while a lot of this seems kind of heavy going, it's all really, really important as we work through it. Someone who will be relieved that they're no longer a part of this is forensic investigator Clifton Frost. We finally finished with his evidence on Tuesday this week. It wrapped up with him being cross-examined about some tape. Liz, is this the tape from the mysterious white van that we talked about in our last episode?
Well, I'm still unsure about that, and the mysterious white van has made no reappearance, but my ears will be peeled for when it does pop up again, if it does. Yeah. And maybe it won't be until the final closings, but that certainly, it's keeping me on tenterhooks.
How was the last few moments of Clifton Frost's cross-examination? Was there anything that stuck out to you from that?
Well, I thought it was rather good that the judge acknowledged that he would be very relieved to be able to go home. He packed up in his quiet, polite way and walked out with some dignity before we got into Jolie's evidence. And we heard him over many days. He gave us a really good picture of what the house was like when they went into it.
Yeah, I was looking at the notes that I've been keeping as we've been going through this. I think he was in the witness box for over a week. It was, you know, the crime scene investigation we've talked about went for 8 days. He spent more time as a part of this trial than he did examining the crime scene at the Palasics home. So a real, really long time. And Liz, yeah, he looked relieved to be finished, to be finally going home and getting back to work.
He did. Actually, I was reflecting on it afterwards, something that he said towards the end about how, you know, how we talked about the DNA was in its infancy. Mm. Well, the practices that people who do his type of work were also evolving. And I thought it was interesting. They used to wear those suits and gloves not to protect the crime scene, but to protect themselves from contaminants, often, you know, blood and biological contaminants and anything like that. Then they realised that it was actually the right thing to do, I think. And so it served them well. And they were only just beginning to realise when they processed that crime scene that that's, you know, something they should be doing.
Yeah. Oh, incredible to see the development of these practices through the eyes of this trial and through the investigation into who killed Irma Palasics in that home invasion in 1999. I mean, we're still working through some delays as this trial, you know, continues. You know, we're week four into what was originally thought to be a sort of a 3 to 6 week trial. What happened yesterday? What slowed things down?
Well, the thing that slowed things down was an act of God. Fog in Sydney, and the poor translator who's been working with Mr. Facconi was unable to get to Canberra, and so we had the morning off, which was quite a relief, really.
I'm sure the jury would have been pleased to have a bit of a rest. James, I'd actually almost completely forgotten that we had a translator with Joseph Facconi as he's listening to the evidence that's being presented, this case against him. What has it been like having that interpreter part of this process?
Well, she has to go along at a fairly decent clip, you would think, in Hungarian to Mr. Vicconi, keeping up with all of the terminology that we've described in this episode so far, let alone all of the numbers and so on, keeping him, you know, informed about what's happening in the trial.
But, of course, Mr. Vicconi has been at the jail, in fact, appearing in the court by a video link, which the jury can see. And this has, I think, probably made things a bit easier for her because she can speak at a normal level and be on mute while they listen in to what's going on in the court.
Yeah, I imagine it's probably a bit of a relief and maybe a bit of help on the neck as well, not bending down right next to his ear throughout the whole process as well. We are getting a lot of questions sent into the case of at abc.net.au, our email address. If you have any questions, if you have any thoughts or reflections, please get in touch. We do love hearing from you. I want to start with a question here today from Andrea. She says, I may have missed it, but did Mr. Palasics mention the offenders drank from the milk/water containers? I'm wondering if this is something he mentioned in passing, and if so, great work for the investigators to pick up on. Liz, how did the investigators know to check these items?
Well, that's because Gregor Palasics told a person who was like a social worker who'd gone to see him, who did give evidence in the trial. And he said to her he'd glimpsed someone drinking something from the fridge. So they knew if they had a look at, if that was had been the case, if they had a look at things you could drink from in the fridge, they might find something. And the allegation is that they did find DNA from each of these two accused people.
Yeah, thank you, Liz. Great question, Andrea, as well. So I appreciate you writing into the case of at abc.net.au. And another one here from Laura. Laura is a long-time listener and a first-time questioner. She's wondering about DNA contamination, so very of-the-moment question. She asks, if DNA is so specific to an individual and they can get samples from minute evidence, why does it matter if it's contaminated? For example, if the milk bottles were touched during production, wouldn't they have to show the defendant had access to the factory? Or if the dog's DNA was on something, wouldn't they just show up as different profiles? Liz, why does DNA contamination matter?
Well, it matters because of DNA transfer and things like that. Just because your DNA is on something doesn't mean you committed the crime. It may be that, you know, say, for instance, it was a towel that might have belonged to you, got washed in a shared washing machine, and then was left at a crime scene by the person who shared the washing machine with you, for instance. And this is something that the defence lawyers will point out, I'm sure. And it's a common thing that DNA being present isn't the whole of the story. And you are right, our listener is right, that you would have to prove other circumstances to say that there was some other way that, or to prove that the DNA had been deposited on the milk bottle, for instance.
And Laura, one thing I learnt in court during the cross-examination is that there is a species marker as part of the DNA testing, i.e. human or other, so the dogs would be ruled out pretty quickly.
Great. Thank you, James. Thank you, Liz. Wonderful question, Laura. Appreciate you getting in touch, sending an email to thecaseof@abc.net.au. If you have any questions yourself, if there's anything you're wondering about, if there's a question nagging at the back of your mind that is stopping you fully engaging with the case of the two intruders, please get in touch. Send an email to thecaseof@abc.net.au. As you can hear, Liz and James love answering your questions and I love reading them out. So don't let that stop you. Also, don't forget to jump onto ABC Listen. That's the best way to listen to The Case Of when we are dropping new episodes, because there's a lot coming up, isn't there, Liz? Where are we going next?
We're still to hear the rest of Jolie's evidence, and we're not quite sure how far she will go on the DNA question. There's still quite a lot of scientific material to come yet, but we haven't even got to the police investigation yet and the undercover operation. So that's hopefully in the next week or so.
Yeah, no, plenty still to come. So grab ABC Listen, best place to listen to The Case Of. Also, best place to listen to so much other wonderful ABC content as well. There's a new season of Expanse out at the moment, the Nun Up 4. So if you're looking for something to listen to on the weekend once you've finished this episode, I'd recommend jumping over and checking that out. And we'll be back in your feed on Tuesday with another episode of The Case Of. This one will be the case of the Wheelie Bin murder. So I'll be back in your feed then. The Case of the Two Intruders is produced by ABC Audio Studios and ABC News. It's reported by Elizabeth Byrne and James Viver and presented by me, Stephen Stockwell. Our supervising producer is Greg Muller and our executive producer is Claire Rawlinson. Thank you to senior lawyer Jasmine Sims, our legal queen, for her legal advice, to the ACT Newsroom and to Audio Studios manager Eric George. This episode was produced on the land of the Ngunnawal, Ngambri and Wurundjeri people.